you know, the people didn't want to be, and again, I'm just speaking from, you know, what I've been told, didn't want to kind of be on record as the only village opposing the Angska thing and all, and they sort of, you know, rescinded and changed their mind or whatever and kind of, you know, went along with the whole thing and all. But they were kind of, as one person described it, tricked into it and all by this kind of pressure tactics and all. And of course, there was a lot of pressure due to this pipeline lawsuit at the time and all. There were a lot of outsiders coming up into the area, clamoring, waiting for the pipeline to happen and wanting jobs and stuff. But anyway, so Angska was passed, and now we have here a letter from BLM to the village council at Stevens Village. This was on February 7th, 1972, so within about 6 weeks after Angska, BLM moved fast on this, saying case closed. As part of the settlement of Aboriginal rights of the Alaska Natives of Angska, all prior conveyance of public land, all Aboriginal titles, if any, are hereby extinguished. All claims are hereby extinguished. So for once, the bureaucracy moved real, real fast and all. I have here also a copy of the injunction that the judge issued, stop halting the pipeline there. Well, basically, the judge told them to Alyeska to make a deal with the people, and so. There was a deal negotiated for the people which gave them the right to, and I have a copy of this here, and this was negotiated by the Alaska Legal Services for the villages that had filed a lawsuit, which gave them the right to employment and training during the construction of the pipeline. But the agreement was to end as soon as the first barrel of oil hit Valdez. So in other words, they didn't have any rights during the operation and maintenance of the pipeline for any, quote, jobs or anything like that, or any benefits from the pipeline. So basically, a few people got a few jobs there for a year or two and all, and that's all. Again, this was another bad deal, you might say, whereby they got very little, you know, out of this agreement. So basically, the people have received little or no economic benefits from this pipeline and the pump station and all this economic development that's gone through their land. And one other thing here, as Alyeska to get their, to get the pipeline license or whatever for the Department of the Interior, had to have a program or a plan to develop employment opportunities for Alaska Native population, quote unquote. And they submitted this plan of action as part of their application. And this was to develop a plan of action designed to train and employ Alaska Natives during construction and operation of TAPS. And so Alyeska submitted this plan of action, and it also involves the actual operation and maintenance of the pipeline too, not only just the construction but the maintenance. And here I quote from this: during the operational phase of the pipeline, Alyeska's objective will be to train and employ Alaska Natives so that within 2 years of startup they will occupy a percentage of jobs at least equivalent to their proportionate share of the total population of the state of Alaska. The native population is estimated at 20%. So Alyeska promises to have 20% native hire on the actual operation of the pipeline and the facilities at Prudhoe Bay. Well, anyways, that was another agreement that never came through. Well, anyways, I guess in conclusion that I'd just like to say that part of Angska's thing was to meet the social and economic needs, and the village corporations didn't receive enough money to meet any of those needs. They just barely got enough money to maybe get the land and to pay for that they got. And speaking as a citizen of the world, you know, I'm concerned that, you know, when I see any people's rights being lost and all, you know, I'm concerned because I can see how if their rights are gone, then like my rights or someone else's rights might be next and all. So I feel that, you know, no man is an island. The bell is tolling for everybody on this. And the only way that, that there's really things are going to be right for everyone, and that we can all feel secure that our rights are going to be respected and all, is that for the Native people in Alaska's rights to be respected. And I'm just speaking as a world citizen and saying that. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lacey. That was a very, very fine historical analysis of what happened at Stevens Village. Thank you.
Harold Henry here again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The person that was talking in the Rampart Dam, they called it a white horse. They're going to put out Fort Yukon, everything. What I want to understand is, what is the first fish conference? We've been living on the Yukon River, and why do they close that fish wheel? The game warden ran right there, and he closed it.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard no noise. You're talking about IRA. But I never heard no noise about Arctic Woods, Vinitai, or Fort Yukon. And another question is, we have the heritage. What is the federal government trying to take over our national government for? National park, I should say. And they have no right to resume a Native cemetery. Where is the justice at? I have a lot of questions to ask you, but now I'll come back tomorrow.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Berger, my name is Gerald Riley. I'm not interested in manifesting problems. I'm interested in manifesting solutions. It's all right to speak of heritages of 50 years ago. I was in Minto in 1952, and they came around and asked if we want to be on a reservation. I said no. I'm an American first. And I would like to make a decent living for myself and my family when I became old enough, and I think I was 14 years old then, and I never sanctioned a reservation, and neither did anyone in the village of Minto. I wasn't aware that Stephen Village was sanctioning a reservation, so that's news to me. I believe, as a part Indian and many other Indians who are part or whole, I believe they like to be self-sufficient. So to get on with the problem, the one thing I'd like to ask you, Mr. Berger, is do you have an answer for these people who have been allotted Native allotments, as the federal government calls them, and yet today they cannot use them as collateral, they're not even owned by the people, and the people are assuming that they own them, and they don't own them. What would be the answer to educate these people enough that the federal government will feel that they're qualified to own their own lands?
Well, I think that's for them to say. The villages we've been to, Mr. Riley, the people that own allotments are happy to have them. I think they know that those are held in trust by the federal government, can't be sold, can't be put up as collateral. But so far, you know, and we're just we've got a lot of places to visit and a lot of people to hear from, but so far, my impression is that they're happy at least to have their allotments. They want them to build a house on, or they want them to do some fishing from, or set snares, or whatever. But they haven't said, I can't go to the bank and put this up as collateral and get a loan to start a business. You know, and I understand your point, but they haven't raised it. It may be that they're not aware of that limitation. I don't know, but they haven't brought it up.
Well, don't you feel, as an advocate of native rights, that you should educate them?
Well, I think they know. I think they know pretty well what their allotments are. For instance, in one village, Tanunuk, a man brought out his certificate from the Secretary of the Interior and read it out to me. I think he understood what the situation was. You know, if, as we go along, it turns out people don't understand what their allotments really are, sure, I think I've got an obligation to say, do you understand that this means that you can't sell it, you can't use it as collateral, and so on. But they seem to be aware of that. You know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they don't know, but that's not been my experience thus far.
My dad is 81 years old. And I just happened to find out 2 days ago he was saying he owned all this land. I went to BLM, and they said he doesn't own it at all. And he was shocked. There's nothing he can do with it. In fact, and by the year 2080, he still will, the children, his children will still have nothing. I'm puzzled by this. By all of this, Mr. Berger, and even today, this gentleman over here, I don't know where he went, there he is, he's advocating that we all live on welfare. Well, I don't want to be a welfare participant. I like to be a prosperous American. Don't you think that's the right of the individual?
Well, I think everybody should have their choice, if Native people say to me at these hearings, look, I've got an allotment, but I want it conveyed to me so that I have the fee simple and so that I can sell it, I can mortgage it, I can do anything I want with it. Well, I'd like to hear that, if that's their view.
Well, isn't that the American way, Mr. Berger?
Well, you're telling me, no doubt it is for many people, but those that have allotments are Americans, and they say, we think these allotments are fine for our purposes. Yesterday, we had a lot of people who were telling us that they hadn't received their allotments. Indeed, there are literally thousands that haven't received their allotments, but they want their allotments first, and then I suppose the next stage might well be, as you urge, I'm an American, you give me the fee simple to this. I don't want simply to be a beneficiary under land held in trust by the federal government.
Well, don't you feel that the American taxpayer, payer, if he understood totally what his taxes were for in the light of the native people, that he is taking care of them? We are not second-class citizens. You know, we like to take care of ourselves. Don't you think if the general public Americans were aware of what their tax monies were doing, that the majority of the Americans are good people, do you think they would go along with this intent and notion if they knew what exactly was going on?
Well, I don't know, but you, I think you have decided views on the subject, and you think they're shared by a lot of Americans, and you may be right. I'm here to find out what Alaska Natives think, and I'm glad that we're hearing all points of view.
I wasn't trying to put you on the hot spot, but look at your coat and look at my shirt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at the color and the difference in between us. There's a perfect example of prosperity on one side and poverty-stricken person on the other side, and I don't really like that. I don't like to be poverty stricken. Thank you, Mr. Berger.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Riley. I think that Nana Poldi wanted to speak. Did you want to? Oh, sorry.
Yes, hello. As an American white woman born and raised outside of Alaska and in a middle-class Republican Anglo-Saxon Christian family and community in rural Michigan, I have a few observations and experiences to share with you today about ANCSA and its impact. Because I live so far away from my family and the people I grew up with, I've had to rely on the many friendships and acquaintances that I have made since I came to Alaska 7 years ago with my small daughter and two suitcases. I am a woman who looks at Alaska Native people as members of nations and cultures other than the one I was accustomed to growing up in. I have learned that cultures other than my own have much to offer me spiritually, that I would not have survived this long anywhere had it not been for the impact that contact with these new cultures in Alaska have had for me. As a true foreigner in this land, I have taken on so much more heart that to learn that there are so many more ways to living, of looking at life, of doing the day-to-day living, of relating, of just being alive. I feel very much at home with myself and my daughter here in Alaska, and I sometimes ask myself why this is so. And it is because I've become assimilated and integrated into these new ways of living. My sense of humanness has been fulfilled. It has been enlarged and expanded like it had never been before. Indigenous people and their ways have had a profound and deeply emotional impact on the depths and expression of my being. Up until 1968, I had been led to believe that there were only white people living in America. I had been told that all of the original peoples in this land had been conquered by the U.S. Army. To think that today, in 1984, I have among my best friends real Aboriginal peoples is truly amazing to me. I had also been led to believe that by my upbringing, that there was only the American way and that that outlook was the best. To think that that monopoly on my mind has been also impacted and that my personal value system has grown and enlarged to such an extent that I, as an American white woman, have some shared values with real people from other cultures coexisting and commingling with me and I with them is truly beautiful. I have been granted these riches just because I recognized and honored them and included new ways into my personal repertoire. Languages different from my own, habits, techniques for doing day-to-day things, foods, childbearing and rearing, family relationships, and religions. This diversity is seeming to gradually and now rapidly disappear from everyday habits of many of my friends, as forces seem to be taking over. I feel grief that I too could be losing so much so fast. I too grew on the land and considered myself a natural person. But due to the American way of raising taxes and taking the land away from small families, even if it had been in the family for three or four generations, which is considered a long time in America, my father has been dispossessed of his land, as have I been. I hope that my friends in Alaska do not end up the same way as my family did recently. It is a terrible experience of loss. It is a lot like the feeling I had last spring when my favorite path off University Avenue through a very old stand of spruce woods had been bulldozed overnight. As I stood there, it was as if I had been placed on the moon. The feeling was one of total loneliness. Now there's a car wash sitting there where the wind and snow and the path and the spruce had once intermingled. Now strangers to me commingle with their cars in a cold shower. My interest in the well-being of my original friends here and elsewhere and in my own well-being is further enriched by the presence of my daughter, whose extended family reside in Utqiagvik and other villages. So far in her 11 years, seven of which have been continuously living in Alaska, I cannot identify anything or any way that she has directly benefited from the Claims Act. It has had absolutely no effect on her other than to identify her as an individual Native person who has had no further claim and who has been disclaimed as a qualified recipient of any stock or profit from any possible dividends. She has no rights under the Land Claims Act living in Fairbanks or Barrow or any other village in Alaska. At the present time, she personally does not identify herself as a Native person. She is not proud to be of her father's people. She sees no future in the original ways. I saw ANCSA come into law. I have lived and observed the changes it has brought to individuals and groups in the last 13 years. It is a tragedy to me that my very own daughter was terminated at such a tender young age. This discord in my home, I have seen all over the villages. Disharmony between mothers, fathers, children, and elders. Everyone going their own separate ways, like my parents and my brothers and I. We all now live in different states. We are not pulling together for each other. This discord that seems to go along with the times here in Alaska has brought about the migration to cities and to other solutions to trying to put things together right. The tribal ways that once impressed me so very deeply seem to be diminishing in the habits of everyday people. And I feel threatened that we will soon all be exactly the same with only one value system sanctioned by some official entity from someplace else. ANCSA has enabled cultural diversity to assert itself somewhat for some individuals, but it has not served to enable the majority of my friends to remain with their land and to raise families and lead a full and productive life on their own land at their own determination at their own time. I favor tribal orientation to life. This type of natural organization seems to enable individuals to be and to express their own full humanity with themselves and with each other and with me. It seems that the Roman model of the city-state has gone too far. I have observed superior individuals and technology among the various cultures in Alaska. My respect grows. I have taken heart when I realized that if a people have the opportunity to select their own type of structure they're going to live with, that every individual has at stake its very success. In Alaska, no one was consulted about what type of arrangement they wanted when the colonial power of the United States government decided to occupy and settle this geographical area. Statehood seemed to have taken over quite by force to the original peoples. I have recently learned that indigenous peoples have rights, civil and political, preserved and protected under international laws. And I've learned that the two main world so-called superpowers do not recognize a lot of international laws when it is in their favor to ignore them. It was in the U.S. government's favor to ignore international laws with regard to Alaska Native people because there were a lot of resources here that the government wished to have in order to preserve itself as a superpower against the USSR and the rest of the world. I have to pay for this attitude every day in the form of seeing some of my original friends lose part of their original humanity. I see ANCSA as a fast buck and a big ripoff. I will continue to lend my support to measures that enable peoples everywhere and anywhere to self-determine in a democratic way, everywhere in the world, on a person-to-person, village-by-village, region-by-region basis about how they want to live. And I will support decisions made at the level of international law concerning this. I want to see the United States government exposed in Alaska as it is now being exposed this week at the World Court in The Hague for mining the harbors of Nicaragua. In closing, I'd like to say that I want to see people respected the way that seeds are nowadays respected in seed banks. Many of the developed and manipulated seeds and hybrids cannot stand up to disease the way the originals of the plant species did. The Western way, with all the forms of government and uniformity, does not serve all people well. Like hybrid corn as a grain, it has a high capacity for production, is hardy, it stores well, animals love to consume it, but because of its manipulated genetic characteristics, if certain blight sets in, the whole crop goes. Whereas with the original wild corns as original peoples, adaptability has already worked itself out, and by its very nature, peoples are suited to the locales wherein they have become accustomed, resisting the very diseases that the newer varieties bring in. People in the world, like original species of corn, need to be protected and allowed to determine and live their own unique adaptation to life. The loss of original peoples and original ways are a loss to me and to all other people. Thank you for offering me this opportunity to participate in my opinion of ANGSA.
Thank you, Ms. Valdi. Thank you very much.
My name is Herbie Bent, and I represent Interior Alaska. I just want to say a few words of how I would feel towards the unclaimed settlement. It was about 10 years ago, 10 or 12 years ago, there was a poster out. And on that poster, it said, you got to fill out an application. And it's to do with land, you know, allotments. And out of clear blue sky, we didn't know what it was. I didn't know what it was. So we filled it out. And maybe 3-4 years later, they said, well, you got an allotment right here. And when they gave me those applications, I didn't know what I was getting into. I'm supposed to know accordingly. They said it was on for 10 years before they came out to the public with it. But when I filled it out, I put down where my land going to be. And when I put down where my land going to be, I didn't put down no location. And pretty soon people start making their allotments, marking them, clearing out a little square space, little place. And when it was my turn, I didn't have nothing to fill out. Now this is the way I feel towards land claim settlement. And I was really upset. I don't know why I filled out that paper. And then when it was time for me to clear my allotment, I had no allotment. Well, they tell me, where did you put your ground down? It struck me so fast and so I don't understand it that I just pointed out. Well, as for a joke, I said up between Dockley and Huslia, up in the pass, halfway up. So when it came right down to business, I didn't own that land. my name was not down because I didn't, I didn't pay attention to what I'm supposed to do. And the reason why I kind of used that thing of between, there's a pass between Hooslea and Ambler, it's Darby, Dockley Mountain Pass. And the only reason why I did that was I thought they were going to put a road or a railroad track or something to go through there. But officially, I don't own nothing. They said, you don't own it. It's not marked right here. So right today, I did fill out that application, and right today, I don't own no land. But my intentions were, I just made a wild guess that I wanted right here for this particular reason, thinking that someday there's going to be a railroad track or a highway through there. That's the only thing that struck my mind. So to show you how not only me, but maybe 20,000 natives think of land claim settlement. They think that it's a, they don't know how important it is, but really they don't know what it is. And I don't have anything against anyone that's working for land claim settlement, but this is the way I feel, and this is the way I think my people feel, that they don't know what they're getting into. They don't know that a lot of them do make allotments. I've seen that. I've seen where my sister had an allotment, my brother and my uncle and my grandfather, I see where they had allotment. But I don't know no allotment. I don't know nothing, and I did fill out that form. So it's kind of a hard thing to understand. I think you have to, in order to understand, you have to be highly educated or whatever it is. What happened to me, and right today, I don't own no land, but maybe someday it might come, but that's what it was when they gave us that application to fill out. And at that time, they said, well, where were you for 10 years, you know? Well, nobody didn't explain to me what was land claim settlement, and it struck me as nothing of interest. It struck me that I wasn't interested in it, because maybe I thought maybe because white man know more about it than I do. Well, I was wrong. I guess I should have known at least 50% was what's happening. So I just wanted to tell these people how land claim came to me. Thank you for your
Thank
time.
You. Thank you, Mr. Ben.
Good morning. My name is Judith Allen. My home is Notak, Alaska. I was born there and presently residing at Kotzebue. And for 2 years, I'm attending the U of A University. I'm interested in learning the movements of the Alaska Native Land Settlement Act claim. And I try to attend meetings every chance I get, except for these past few days, I couldn't make it to any of them because of my real heavy schedule in classes and the exams. And last night I went to a meeting. That was my first chance, but they brought me to a wrong hotel. And I come in, people were walking out. I was disappointed. But anyway, I tried to make it this morning. I had to run for my bus. First of all, I'm concerned about the education. I have about two things to talk about here. About the education in Alaska, up at the Nana region where I come from. For 5 years, I try to teach bilingual in the school. And each time we have our in-services, the annual in-services for that area, I hollered, kind of hollered and said, why don't you recognize these bilingual instructors? They're just the people that didn't go to school and are teaching it in the schools since the bilingual education's been integrated the last, 15 years to most of them. And it's just about 7 years now in Kotzebue alone. This is one of the reasons why I come to university, because the school district where I came from didn't seem to have a ear on this. I come directly from the classroom. I think the children sees right through you. I used to come home with that feeling, because they know that we don't have piece of paper like the regular certified teachers. Seems like they see right through my heart that I wasn't a fit teacher. So I tried to holler for 5 years to have some kind of a recognition, not the educated teachers had, but something anyway to show the children that you're interested in teaching them the culture, the language they are almost totally lost. And this is the reasons why I'm attending school, so I can try to get me a teacher certificate. It's hard, but I don't want to give up. And I talked about what I already wrote, and I feel a Native person and a Native educator, which I enjoy doing. A Native educator needs to have a bilingual education program certification. I feel our children, as beneficiaries of our land owners under Alaska Native Land Settlement Act, through heritage only, at least needs and already knows that they don't want a teacher who just is a plain uneducated somebody whom they are trying to learn from. It gets kind of hard sometimes, especially in Kotzebue alone. We didn't have any materials that time, and we had to borrow some materials from the smaller villages to try and teach it. And I was the first instructor there. And it was really hard, because some were not even interested in learning it. I used to go home with this feeling, how come my own people don't want to learn their own culture, their language, and they should be proud of it? I used to come home with that sadness. I'm real proud that I didn't lose my language. I feel real lucky that I didn't lose it, and I want to teach it best as I could. I feel privileged in this meeting to open my mouth regarding our future children, Native children. Right now, some are not even motivated in learning it, the heritage that they had. And I think, when I think of the 1971 issue, I would think back these past few years. You know, I had no idea myself that we were going to sell it, but I'll talk about this a little bit later. I have a big question in my mind. The children, the Native children that were born after 1971, don't have any lands except through heritage. They can acquire that. I know they're going to ask a question, how come I was omitted? You know, it's going to be a question 200 years from now. And the issue of 1971, in learning about the allotted lands, who owns them, who will sell them under the Alaska Native Land Settlement Act claim. In my area, We were very happy to acquire the land that time. But I don't think they were told, even myself, I wasn't told that I could sell it later on in 1991, until 2 years ago when I started to attend the university. I attended all those meetings since I was in that class under Native Studies. They, each one of the leaders from Alaskan leaders or from the corporation, they all stressed it out to us that there are going to be a sale. This is the first time I understand this. And they would tell us, we should tell our young people not to sell the lands. You know, this is the first time for me too. It kind of infuriates me. It's a confusion in my mind. How in the world we're going to tell our young people to not to sell their lands? Because I know for a fact at home the young people are kind of crazy for money. They will sell it. I know when the BLM helped me, came to my house one time and asked me if I wanted to go with him on an airplane to go put a mark on my land. He even had a map and size of it. I wondered, you know, by now if it was marked the right way. I believe sometimes the people that makes the maps makes mistakes, and I just want to tell you, the commission, or I've got a question if they always mark the lands the right way, if they measured them right. That's my question.
I don't know the answer to that. I suppose they must do their best, but whether they get it right every time, it's another matter.
Because in one meeting I went to, they were not marked, and they had to get a person that lived there all the time. The marks they put out and put out to legislation, they were not accurate, and so they had to get this resource person, the person that lived in the area, to also make a mark, and that resource person's mark was correct, mm-hmm. accurate than the what BLM did, and that's why I ask a question. There's a question in my mind right now when 1991 comes around. Did the corporation sold us out of our stock when we were allotted lands? Was there an agreement that we could sell them later? I already talked about this, that I was, you know, I'm just learning that we can sell them. And they warned us. That's why I wonder if we'll have time to tell our young people today, don't sell your lands. Another one they told us in the meetings was to watch out for the seven eye. When I vaguely have an idea what it is, even though I went to it. I have to go to several meetings to understand what that is. They says to watch out for the seven eye. I wonder what they mean by that. I'm worried. And when I studied the first American Indians, this same thing seems to me that things are happening to what happened to the first American Indians when the government wipe them out of their sovereign rights. They were allotted, you know, reservationed, and then kicked out, and they used military, And Alaska have a huge military force. You know, politicians always have their way, no matter how much they will hurt a person's mind, their mental status, even if they had to kill a person those days. I'm worried how it's gonna be after 1991. Today seems like the main issues that's being talked about is the land. When the money goes that we acquired from selling of our lands, where are we going to live? This land, after all, we live from it. We lived out of our land, the Indians, the natives, the native Eskimos. We still live out of our lands. And no matter how much we buy from the stores, it doesn't fit into a lot of us natives. It doesn't fill our stomach. And what kind of, we cannot live without the resources, the animals and vegetation. These are the thoughts today. And I forgot this paper here. I was gonna say it's on education during the Sheldon Jackson days. You know, they had control of our lands, the educational service. They taught English and tried with their might to destroy the native language in each school. And we know that in all over areas in Alaska. They exchanged science, social studies, math for Anglo students, provided health care, few hospitals, nurses, doctors, medicine, and substituted old ways, old traditions through the Roman Catholic structure. Right now, it's happening to us. You know, when we think of welfare, and I know at home, my husband and I had to go to public assistance for stove oil. Because at home, it's not as much as the rural villages, the smaller villages. They pay $150 a drum to $160 per 50-gallon barrel. That's a lot of cash for stove oil, fuel, to keep us warm. And it's real cold up in the Arctic. And this year we had to go to the public assistance. They gave us a piece of paper to purchase oil. And when I think of this, I picture it, that big pipe and that oil going out at Seward somewhere, going out of Alaska. How come we're paying so much for stove oil like that, fuel oil? This is under public assistance. I think they substitute these, we get help from through public assistance. They call it energy assistance. See, the government is real tricky to me. The politicians are tricky. We have to really watch out for our own selves if we want to continue and live in Alaska in our homes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Allen.
Yes, sir. Joe Beatish.
How do you do, sir?
Mr. Hughes, I'm really from Alakaka, Tapkaiko, Chris. I'm going to try to say a few things about it. I never been going to school when I was small, you know. I'm 69 years old now. And I make my living off the land. And all my life, you know, all I raised my kids. I raised 10 kids, you know. And I do a lot of trapping, hunting, fishing. And that's all I know. I never learned much from white people. But I did working for wages to make my living. Drawing employment in winter, by hunting, trapping, and that's the way I make my living. I'm 69 years old now, and I'm a Athabaskan Indian from Keokuk River. And about this land, you know, I make my living off the land subsistence, you know, fishing and all that. And then that's the way, not only me, all my people all over. You know me, I'm old. I'm a retired man, all right? But how about my kids? They're just beginning, and they got long ways to go if they're going to live off the land. That's the way I look at it. Like my old people, myself. And I already learned them how to trap, hunting off the land. So, I ain't got much to say, but I like to talk for my young people. I wish they'd take good care of it and then talk about this land. This is the time to say something about the land before we're going to lose it. We don't like to lose it. And about this dam, electricity dam, what they're talking about. How are we going to get our fish up Yukon River? Keokuk River, Tana River. Most of my people live on fish. And if they make a dam above there, how are they going to get their salmon? That's just the way I look at it. It's going to be hard. Now, if they make a dam, well, they're going to move a lot of animals away. And the people that live at the villages closer to the dam, they wouldn't have nothing to live on of the land. Subsistence. So that's going to give us a lot of trouble. And this is the time to talk about it, said something about it. You know, me, I'm old, but how about my people, my young people? They got long ways to go, and they need the land. I know. Because we born and raised around here, and their parents teach them how to make a subsistence off the land. And a lot of them are going to live that way, like me and my grand people. So, you people go ahead and have a meeting over the dam, and about the land, and I wish these people, my people, that said something about what they need. They're just beginning. They're young. And if they take good care of themselves, they got 60 or 70 years to live yet. And they need the land. I don't come in here for meeting myself, but I just want to listen. You know, I'm pretty sure somebody wants me to say something about the land subsistence, like. And I know that when they talk about that dam, it's going to give us a lot of trouble. If it's something wrong, then it's going to flood the villages and everything and all. It's kind of hard. That's all I've got to say.
Thank you, sir. Yeah. Thank you very much. Well, does anybody else want to speak before we take a break for lunch? Well, I want to thank all of you who spoke this morning. It was a very worthwhile morning, and I do appreciate the presentations that were made by each one of you. They were very, very interesting and very, very informative. I guess this is as good a time as any to adjourn for lunch and then come back this afternoon. What time should we come back, Mary?
It's 12 o'clock right now.
1:30? Mm-hmm. All right, well then we'll adjourn until 1:30 and we'll see you at that time.
Really.